foes, they're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group, since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link. They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace. Was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think. They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger. Curtail our speech, our movement, our rights, but we won't give up.
We're about to fight. With the wave of the flag, our liberty shrink.
They say code fear,
we say code pink.
With the wave of the flag, our liberty shrink. They say code fear,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger.
Code Pink by Emma's Revolution. I'm Noor of Code Pink. Welcome to our Code Pink radio show presented by WBAI 99.5 FM in NYC, WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and many other community radio stations like Western Mass Community Broadcasting, WMCB LP 107.9 FM. We're also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Check out our website at www.codepink.org/radio, where you'll find all our episodes from episode 1 to our most recent. I'm here again from the DePaul University encampment with Yolanda, who is one of the main marshals here keeping the encampment safe. Later we're going to hear from another very special guest, but I'll save that for a surprise for the second half. But welcome, Yolanda. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, everybody. Thank you guys for having me.
Yolanda has been an organizer since she was a freshman in high school. Today, she's taking up a role here at the DePaul University encampment as a marshal, making sure people are safe, making sure Zionist agitators are warded off. And we're just going to talk to her about how that's been. So can you describe a little bit of what your role has been here and what that's entailed?
So my role here basically is to patrol, to make sure, you know, all marshals are on the same page, that each entrance is being patrolled and the whole perimeter and even inside the encampment, that everybody is taken care of. Our duties ranges from keeping them safe to making sure that they have what they need, such as tents and food, and picking up any slack that is left to pick up around the camp.
So basically, if somebody needs anybody, they can look for you.
Yes.
Okay, so why do people actually need to be kept safe here? Like, what kind of threats are the people in the encampment facing?
So we're facing a couple of threats. So we are facing the university's private police, and then we are also facing CPD repression, and then Zionists from the local neighborhoods and even like neighboring neighborhoods. They come at various times of the day. They like to show themselves at night when everybody's usually sleeping. That's when really my role comes into play. I stay up pretty much most of the night till sunrise because a lot of different various Zionists, they come in at night seeking to wreak havoc and cause danger and just upset the encampment, or just to get it to the point where they get it shut down. So we make sure nothing escalates from those situations, that nobody isn't even woken up from their sleep, and that it's de-escalated as quickly as possible. And the Zionists are moved off the campus, especially when they're acting inappropriately. A lot of them, they come at night, they come drunk, they come high, and they come off various different substances looking to wreak havoc, and we properly handle those situations.
When I like see the different instances here of like Zionists or police coming to disturb the encampment, I think a lot about back home in Palestine. Both me and Yolanda are Palestinian. And I think about how we have to kind of deal with these situations in the same way back home, like the threat of the occupation, like the Israeli military or the Israeli police, but also settler violence is something that Palestinians have to adapt to and take care of themselves, because you know, there's nobody for us to call here at the camp, and there's nobody for Palestinians to call back in Palestine. If a Zionist is agitating them, they can't call like the Israeli military or anything to help them. So that's just one thing that I feel like has been weighing on me heavily, just the fact that we only have each other. And a lot of times that feels negative, but recently it's kind of been feeling empowering. Do you see like parallels here at the camp and like back home in Palestine?
I see a lot of different similarities. How community-based this encampment has become reminds me of how community-based Palestinians are in Palestine, in the villages. Also, the way that we do keep each other safe, like we really do protect each other, and in the same sense that Palestinians back home really do protect each other from settler violence or from occupation violence, whether it's from the Israeli military or the PA, which is just an extension of the occupation. We understand that these people that have been put into power, whether it's in Palestine or it's in America, that they don't have our best interests at heart, but we do. We know what's best for us. We talk to each other. We get to know each other. We meet each other's families. We grow bonds. We grow relationships that will last way longer than this encampment, will last outside of this encampment, and we'll be like, will be the hope for us in the long run. And I see that in Palestine when you walk down the street and this random ammu is telling you about where he comes from, and he's asking you about where you come from and how he knew your grandfather, and then he gives you a free falafel sandwich, and then you know you go about your day, and then you see him the next day and you know you have a better interaction, and then the next day it's like, this is your ammu. And this shows here too, like one day we go from strangers and then we talk to each other, and then now we are friends and we are comrades in the same struggle. And it relates a lot to Palestine. And another thing that relates a lot is that the Zionist attacks that happened at the encampment, they steal, they destroy things. They are constantly being violent, with whether it's verbally or physically. And in Palestine, it is happening, if anything, 10 times the fold. Their Palestinians are being constantly stolen from, whether it's their land, their property, anything, their belongings, whether it's the things in their fridge or their lives. They're constantly being stolen from. They're constantly facing settler violence or occupation violence. And there's a lot of different correlations and a lot of different similarities that you can make between the encampments here and the brutal occupation in Palestine.
Yeah, I think the thing that resonated with me the most about what you said is the fact that you're building interactions with people. You're building kind of like a familial bond in a sense. Like, you start to become very like trusting of the people here in a way, and like just feeling very comfortable with them, because in a sense you're trusting them with your life. Like, you're understanding that the person in the tent next to you is like the person who's gonna help you if like something goes down, or that person in the tent with you. Me and Yolanda are actually sharing a tent here.
Yeah.
And it does speak to our relationship too. Like, we did become friends through organizing, and I feel like because of that, we do also have like a strong bond, and I feel like I trust Yolanda with my life.
Yeah. But also, like, the thing about it is that we break bread with these people, we eat with these people, we sleep next to these people.
Yeah. We wake up and we see them in the
morning. We go to the same bathroom, we are having the same conversation. We all feel the same way. That's why we are here. And we understand that one person is not going to free Palestine, that it's going to take a collective, and that if something happens here, one person is not going to save us. One person is not the end all be all. And we understand this, and we understand that collectively we are stronger together than divided, and that if anything happens, that we can rely on each other, and we can confide in each other how we do when we eat and we sleep next to each other. We can confide in them when our life is in danger.
Yeah, for me, I guess I never like expected to be in a position where, I mean, I guess in a way I kind of did, but to this extreme where I like really feel like I am meant to protect the person's life, like who's next to me, because that's just become like a real threat, a threat to our lives. I think in so many ways there's parallels to back home in Palestine, like the way, you know, mothers, for example, have to become like a stronghold of their home, just like a little foreshadowing for our conversation later. But there's like a lot of readjusting of roles, people taking on things that they maybe never would have taken on. Obviously, one of those is being in a situation where maybe you're de-escalating from a Zionist agitator or even the police. Have you had to take on a role like that? And how do you go about it? And like, maybe do you have like a little story to share?
Yeah. So like, as like some background, we're at DePaul University, and I am not an alumni here. I have not been here. I did take some classes with my sister, but my sister is an alumni here. And so the responsibility is not mine at all. But it is mine, because me being a Palestinian, these encampments are going against everything that is holding my people under oppression. And if I want to help my people in any way, I will help the people and the encampments and the things, the strategies people are taking up to defeat the same beast that we are facing in Palestine. So it is my responsibility, and then it isn't. And an instant where I had to kind of go against what I believe, because as a Palestinian, as a person who has faced settler violence, my family has faced settler violence and oppression from the police and this government, this U.S. government, talking to the police can be very triggering, because as a person that has called the police for help and they have done nothing, talking to them or even engaging in any sort of conversation feels normalizing, and especially with Zionists. And two nights ago, there was a Zionist that came. He was belligerently drunk, and he smelled, he reeked of certain chemicals that smelled like drugs. And he, you know, he was here to wreak havoc. He began in the middle of the circles shouting Islamophobic slurs, and he was saying how we deserve to be raped, and that Islam doesn't, that we're gonna go to hell because we're Muslim. He was even saying this to people that weren't Muslim. You know, we're all Arab, so he thinks that we're all Muslim. And you know, it's just a stereotype of being Arab. But he put his hands on some of the marshals. We were trying to de-escalate the situation. And it was, mind you, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. He came and he told us, he's like, well, I'm here because I'm bored. And you guys are going to give me the excitement that I want. And see, the thing about us marshals is that we de-escalate. We don't give them the excitement that they want. We don't give them the reaction that they want. We give them the exact opposite. And that's what we gave him. And it enraged him even more. And it caused him to become violent. And he physically tried to harm women and men, young freshmen marshals that have been taking up these responsibilities as young people in the community, and he had put them their lives in danger, essentially, because he's intoxicated, it's unpredictable what he might do, and also he's a Zionist and he's inherently violent, because who comes to a sleeping encampment at 3 o'clock in the morning screaming and shouting a bunch of Islamic phobic and anti-Arab racist slogans, yeah. If they're not violent, you know? He was trying to arouse violence and he didn't get that, but we had to escort him off the premises because it's very inappropriate to be on a dry campus, drunk and high and screaming and throwing things at people, hitting people, screaming at women in their faces, touching women inappropriately while he's intoxicated. The whole situation was inappropriate. So we had to escort him off the premises. And we had to, at one point, all the marshals had to form a blockade because this man was trying to get in through any entrance that he could find that was open so that he can further disrupt the encampment. And he was even trying to destroy tents. He was even trying to destroy people's property. Sorry, guys, I'm on duty.
Yolanda's walkie-talkie is going off because she's actually on marshaling duty right now.
But I turned it off. But that was just one instance of, like, and he comes back every other night around the same time. So we're used to him. He actually is a student at DePaul. He's a very sick and twisted man. He only comes here to cause mayhem and destruction. And we never allow him to get that. And that's an instance of the community keeping the community safe and not allowing any infiltrators to cause harm to anybody, whether they are sleeping or awake.
Thank you. I was there that night and it was pretty annoying, honestly. Like, he definitely came with the intention of getting a reaction, maybe like a physical reaction. It seemed like he was trying to provoke people to, like, respond to him in whatever way to just disrupt the camp. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what their intentions are, to make us lose sight of our goals and to throw away, like, what we've been working for. But that's not going to happen. And I'm really proud of Yolanda and all the marshals here. They've honestly shown so much discipline in the way that they've dealt with these people who are honestly violent and
racist, exactly. White supremacists, exactly. That are looking to harm us. He literally, you know, he shouted at us the most horrific things, and knowing that our people are going through these horrific things in person in Palestine, it's very triggering to, you know, deal with these sorts of people face to face. But for the safety of the community, for the safety of the encampment, for the safety of all the students that are here, all the community members, we must deal with it accordingly. And we must put aside our triggering emotions and our PTSD to handle these situations appropriately, so that they don't get violent and so that we don't show them what they want us to be. We don't prove to their point that we're barbarians or that we're violent. We prove to our point and to the world's point that, no, they are violent. And this is what they bring to us. And we have no other choice but to act accordingly.
Exactly. So would you say that being here at the camp and being a marshal has taught you more about community care and self-discipline?
Oh, yes. It's taught me a lot about restorative justice, about, you know, a lot of these people in my community, I've known them for a very long time. And sometimes we may have difference of opinion, whether it's political or if we think a bunny is hopping the right way. You know, we always have these debates and arguments, and it shows a testament of how healthy we can be and how conversations with our community is a healthy thing. And it taught me a lot about restorative justice. It taught me a lot about that I'm not the only one going through this. I'm not the only one feeling this pain, this trauma, this urge to do something, that I need to do something, that something needs to be done. I share these feelings with a lot of people. And yeah, this encampment has taught me a lot, and it has allowed me to grow and be more disciplined and allow people to care for me as I care for others and put my life in other people's hands as they put their lives in mine.
Yeah, I definitely second everything that you said. I couldn't put it better myself, but thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to say to our people back home, to the students at encampments, to the Palestinians back home who've had to take up roles that maybe they never thought they would take?
I think my message for Palestinians, for students at these encampments, for community members that are looking to do something, my message is the same for all of you guys. We must seek liberation and not negotiations. And we should never negotiate whether our morals should be tested or whether our morals are smeared because of the government that we live under. And no matter what, we should not engage in normalizing tactics by Zionists or by this government, by any government entity. And that we should only seek liberation, and where the closest liberation zone, you must seek it out, and you must go there, and you must help the community build their liberation, and you must help the masses reach their mass consciousness so that we could seek liberation and not negotiations. And you should never negotiate if what you're doing is right, and if it's on the behalf of the Palestinian people. If you have the true intention of Palestinians and you want the self-determination and freedom of Palestinians, you should never let nobody negotiate if your morals are correct. Never let nobody negotiate if you are right or if you are wrong. If you are standing on the side of the oppressed, you should never allow these normalizing conversations, and seek liberation.
Exactly. It reminds me of Hassan Kanafani when he said
that. That is his quote.
Yeah, the conversation between the oppressed and the colonizers, between the sword and the neck.
Yeah, it is.
There's no negotiation when you're talking about your life. You can't put compromises on your livelihood and your identity.
Yeah, also, you know, don't ask me when my boot is on their necks why my boot is there. Ask them. They'll be able to tell you. Because just like how you want me to answer why their boot is on my neck, why? They know why their boot is there. I know why my boot will be there in one day, inshallah, when we get the liberation of our people. Don't ask me. Ask them why my boot is on their neck. They'll be able to answer the question.
Thank you, Yolanda, for ending us off on some strong words. And thank you to our listeners. You guys are listening to Code Pink Radio, coming to you through Pacifica Radio's WPFW in Washington, D.C., WBAI in NYC, KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. We'll be back after this break with a special guest. You guys will see soon. Thank you guys so much for listening.
ميل على بلدي لتشوف كيف البحر بيضحك لتشم تراب بلادي وترسم احجار ومجدك
ميل على بلدي لتشوف كيف البحر بيضحك لتشم تراب بلادي ترسم احجار ومجدك
ميل على شاطئ حيف
تدلك من رمل وتسكر صورة بشوارع يافا وعلى صورة العكة مشوار
ميل على شاطئ حلو خدلك من رمل وتسكر صورة بشوارع يافا على صورة العكة مشوار
ميل على بلدي لتشوف كيف البحر كيف البحر بيضحك لك القدس وشوارعها وسماها أجمل مكان ميل عنا وسأل عنا احنا للكرم عنوان
وإذا بدك تتهنى الناصرة بتبعت سلام قعدت تحلى ميت قلب وجودك حلو الكلام
ميل على وادي عار ركوة القهوة عنا شرفنا حارة حارة قلوبنا لعيونك دار
ميل على وادي عار وركوة القهوة عالنار شرفنا حارة حارة قلوبنا لعيونك دار
ميل على بلدي لتشوف كيف البحر
كيف البحر بيضحك لك
لفيت بلاد لفيت ملقت بجمالك ملقت ولا حتى جبالك والورد عصافيرك بتغني يا ليل 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 ليل
دلعون بلادي غنيت وعالميجانة ربيت وضحية غازل بالدبك وعتر
لحكى يا ستي حنيت ولمتنا بساحة البيت ورغيف الزيت وزعطر وشجر الزيتون
ومشيت يا ما وشيت أغلى من بلادي ملقيت شعر وأدب وعلم وفن وأحلى الألحان
لفيت بلاد لفيت
ملقيت بجمالك ملقيت ولا حتى جبالك والورد وعصافيرك بتغني يا بلاد
دلعون بلادي غنيت وعلمي جانا ردت ضحية غازل بالدبك وعتر
لحكى يا ستي حنيت لمتنا بساحات البيت ورغيف الزيت وزعتر وشجر الزيتون
ومشيت يا ما وشقيت أغلى من بلادي ما لقيت شعر وأدب وعلم وفن وأحلى الألحان
Welcome back. I'm Nood with Code Pink, and you're listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. On our first half of this radio show, we talked to Yolanda, who is one of the main marshals at the DePaul University encampment. We talked a lot about community care, repression, and the ways the occupation forces us to take up different roles in our community, even here in the U.S. Right now, we have a very special guest, the moment you've all been waiting for.
With Mother's Day around the corner on Sunday, May 12th, I wanted to bring in Osri, known to her friends as Oz and known to me as Mom. So welcome, Mom.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So we want to kind of talk a little bit about what I talked about with Yolanda about, you know, taking up different roles in the occupation. But as somebody who lived back home in Palestine, I think you bring a really unique perspective of how a family unit can kind of be restructured or forced to be restructured because of the occupation. And, you know, people like oftentimes mothers have to step up and be, you know, the forefront of a family, you know, whether a father is murdered by the occupation or put in jail, you know, and, you know, it can happen to sons as well. So how do you feel like the occupation shapes roles within a community back home in Palestine, especially for mothers?
Well, I think it does so in a lot of ways. I think obviously, like, one of the most obvious ways is it forces us to take our own safety and our own security into our hands. We are constantly under attack, whether it's physical or psychological or mental. The occupation is constantly over us. It's like this huge gray cloud. And I think for mothers in particular, my mother included, who was a mom of five, they are not just our caregivers, but they're literally our frontline security force. My brothers are older than me, and they were, like many young teenage boys in Palestine, subject to just indiscriminate arrest and detainment for made up charges, sometimes no charges at all. So it is the mother's job at that point to be the force and the barrier between her children and the occupation forces. Whereas in other places, the mother is the caregiver, the one that just cooks and takes care of her kids and helps them with their homework. There's an added burden to being a Palestinian mother, where you are on alert all the time. You are surveillance. You are security. You're the army for your children. And I saw that in many instances living back home, with my mother being the example of that.
Yeah. And I feel like everything you're describing, just with the time you spent in Palestine, you also have like adopted those qualities, and like I feel like you really exhibit them here in the US, like raising us, and like even just with the type of repression that we experience here in the US for being Palestinian and like advocating for Palestine, we've never really been quiet about it. And you know, you definitely have always been that barrier and have always been that advocate for like me and my siblings. So, you know, like I really see that brought here to the US, and you know, we can talk a little bit about how that shows up in the camps later, but it definitely ingrained something in you for sure. But
I don't think, like, as a Palestinian woman, you actually have to have lived in Palestine. I think that the repression, the oppression, I think that's just something that we carry with us as a community, no matter where we are in the world. And I feel like that's something that is particularly unique to the Palestinian community, where I don't think that you have to be born in Palestine. And I think that's because it's not ancient history, you know? you have a parent that was born there, you have a grandparent that is alive and like telling you the oral history of what they experienced in 1948 and the Nakba and displacement and the murder of their family, which is your family. And I think that's something that is that type of taking up a different role is just innate to us because our experience is ongoing regardless of where we are.
Exactly. And us Palestinians, you know, we really hold that duty even here in the U.S. or, you know, at least a lot of us do. And we spent a lot of time in Chicago where there's a lot of Palestinians. So
yeah.
Your community also like really invigorates you, and we replicate in a lot of ways life back home. And you've been to the camps. You came to the DePaul encampment a few times.
Yes.
Do you see parallels there? I gave you a little tour. But do you see any parallels in the camp to life back home in Palestine?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, number one, it's a close community. You feel community the minute you arrive. And I think just that sense of looking out for one another, because as Palestinians, we're all we've got, right? When you're a Palestinian back home, your Palestinian village, your Palestinian community is all you've got. And I immediately, as soon as I arrived at the camp, I felt like all of these people, all of these different races, different backgrounds, different ethnicities, genders, it was like that became this tight-knit community of, you know, we're all we've got, and we're going to protect each other and be there for each other and ultimately stand up for what's right. And I'm not gonna lie, as soon as I walked onto the encampment, I felt like everybody's mom.
Oh.
So I felt like everybody's Palestinian mom.
You always feel like everybody's mom.
Yeah, I can't get away from that. But it did feel very much like being back home, that experience of, you know, our village protecting our village.
Yeah, exactly. And it does feel like a Palestinian village, honestly, with
yes.
The way like people are also being so resourceful with things and like
yes.
just figuring things out and using what they have. I feel like that's also like very Palestinian.
Yes. And even with the sharing of resources, and you know, what's mine is yours and what's yours is mine, and everyone feeling comfortable and safe and just, you know, with these open tents and everyone's belongings, and no one is really, you know, everyone just feels like they're in a safe, protected space. And that really felt like that what it feels like to be in a Palestinian village.
Nice. Yeah. I wish I could compare it to the experience of living there, but hopefully one day I'll be able to. But from like the time I spent like in our like home village in Palestine, that's literally exactly what it felt like.
Yeah. And there is always that outside looming factor. Like here at the encampments, it's CPD, and back home it's the IOF. So there is that outside factor of, you know, just looming danger always. And if that danger wasn't there, then we wouldn't have that need to always be on guard and aware and looking out for one another in that sense.
Exactly. Yeah. Like in Palestine, something me and Yolanda talked about, like in Palestine, you can't call like the police to come help you.
Right.
We're in the U.S. like we can't call the police to come help us either.
Right.
If we call the police to our camp, they're going to take it as an invitation to take it down.
Right.
So we're definitely not going to be doing that. But a lot of people that I talked to were saying like, you know, they're taking up roles they never expected to, and you know that this like situation, the repression, is kind of like, you know, forcing people to do things that they've never done before. Do you feel like that applies to you. You know, you said you felt like everybody's mother and like this is how it is. Do you feel like because you had that experience living back home that this was something that was kind of like a no-brainer, or do you also feel like it's showing up in ways that you weren't expecting?
I mean, I think that just especially now with everything that's going on in Palestine, even if it's like not an obvious change of role or taking up a role you never thought you would, it is an obvious shift in your perspective. You look at work differently. You look at life differently. You look at buying groceries differently. You are forced to kind of take a step back from your life, mm-hmm. and understand how everything you do, from the companies you support to, you know, the places where you're employed, everything you do has an impact. And I think that's just a shift in perspective. I mean, I guess it could be kind of a shift in a role, because you can take up a role where it's a vehicle of change,
mm-hmm.
where you are like a driver of change and you impact that type of change that makes an impact on people in Palestine. And I mean, I think that, you know, that is a shift. But I think as Palestinian here in the US, our roles are never regular. I don't know if that makes sense, but our roles are never regular. I don't think that we have the privilege to have a comfortable, quote unquote, normal role, because I think we are so tied mm-hmm. to our Palestinian communities back home that it just, I don't even know what normal is. Like, I could be in a meeting or, you know, just talking to a coworker, and their small talk is way, way different than my small talk, right? Because my role in this world is not, quote unquote, normal.
Exactly. Yeah, your small talk is explaining the Nakba, starting at 1948.
Yes, I literally just had this conversation yesterday with someone that I had lunch with, and it was just like, I don't know, do I want to talk about Mother's Day that's coming up? I don't, you know, I want to talk about, you know, the resistance. I want to talk about why it's okay for us to resist and why it's necessary even for us to resist. And how do you want me to love my oppressor? I mean, this was the conversation I was having. And I make no apologies for it, because this is the life that I'm forced to live right now.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why you and like Palestinian mothers, honestly, like, are our heroes, and everybody who is part of this community is kind of like our heroes in a way. Like, you kind of look to people with this certain respect, but obviously, you know, when it comes to mothers, like, at least for me, just because of the role that you played in my life, like, for everybody listening, like, this woman is a driving force, like, not just for her family, but literally wherever my mom is, like, she's uplifting everybody with her, and she's doing it gracefully, honestly. Do you have any like stories from back home of some heroism that you witnessed from my grandmother, your mother?
Yeah. Well, there are many stories, but I'll share one, because this is one that is my own Roman Empire. I literally think about this story just about every single day. And it was late 70s, early 80s. We were on curfew. And for those of you who don't know, curfew is when the occupation forces come in, basically warn you either through a leaflet or through like bullhorns as they drive through in their military jeeps in our village. And they warn you that a curfew is coming, and they give you about an hour or two to pull yourself together, get water, get food, whatever it is, whatever supplies that you need. And you never know how long that curfew can last. It could be a day, it could be a week, 2 weeks. And during the curfew, your movement is restricted to inside your home. So there's no school, There's no work. There's no any type of outdoor activity. You have to stay inside. And at a certain point during the day, after dark, I think they give you about an hour or so after dark, you're not allowed to turn on your lights, even in your own home. And if you do turn on your lights, they have been known to shoot directly into your windows. And needless to say, my mother would stay up at night to make sure that when we got up to drink water or go to the bathroom, none of us were turning on lights, because that was literally life-threatening to get up as a child to go to the bathroom in your own home.
And you're not thinking about that, you know, like as a kid, like also
oh,
as
no, you're not.
It's
you're
an
not.
Instinct. You turn on the light, yeah. Get up.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And I remember one time, I have a brother who's younger than me, and I'm not sure. And it was the middle of the night, and my brother was just crying. He was crying, and my mother had ran out of milk that she normally gets from our neighbors. And when I say neighbors, I mean we're like separated by small fields. So I remember that night, my four brothers and I watched as my mom snuck out in the dark, as our home was surrounded by IOF military, armed IOF military, and she snuck out in the middle of the night, hiding between bushes and trees and stone walls, and made her way to the neighbors. And I just remember thinking, we are never going to see my mom again. Like, they're either going to detain her or they're going to kill her. And most likely the latter. And she made it to the neighbors, somehow managed to get the milk, and managed to get back home. And when we talk about heroism and taking on a new role, I mean, she was on a covert mission. Like, she was it was like she was trained for that moment. And that's what I think just Palestinian women are. They're just heroes. And like, I know people like to use the word resilient, but I just think it's beyond resilience, right? I think it's this like innate courage that Palestinian women have, whereas like resilience is, to me, you are faced with adversity and you kind of get through it and you manage to come out the other end. But I think with Palestinian women, and like specifically, it's this innate kind of deep-seated courage where you face your adversity like face to face, literally in real life, and you don't just get through it, like you just topple it, and you do what you need to do to protect your children, to protect your village. And Palestinian women are at the forefront of that, right? They are the ones that are raising these children that are going to grow up and, inshallah, within our lifetime, see a free Palestine.
Inshallah. I was hoping you would share that story because I love it so much. And it also is like, that's something you would do and like make it back. And like, I would know, like, I would be scared, but I would know that you would do what you need to do. Like, you would make it back. And like, it makes me want to like confidently say that I would do that too. Like, I know I would do it, but you're also way more capable than I am. So I don't know if I would make it back.
I think you would.
I hope so. But we are coming up to a close, but I wanted to ask you, is there anything you would want to say? You would want to just like tell the people listening about the women in Palestine and the women in Gaza, and just something kind of to keep in mind when thinking about them?
I think that they just want to live life, right? They just want to raise their children and see them succeed and, you know, even themselves, they may want to live a life that is, you know, feels fulfilled, whether it's just, you know, raising the kids and planting the flowers and you know, doing the things that make them the mothers that they are, or even like things that are more fulfilling to them, like having an education or having a career, which I think that we all also forget that is also an obstacle to many people in Palestine. But I think that just remember that they are humans who just want basic human rights and to live their lives in a way that makes them comfortable having that small talk without all of their fears and their anxieties in the back of their heads, you know?
Yeah.
And I want to say that to everyone that's out there in the streets every single day, and every person at the encampment, that I think that they're doing a fantastic job. And I think that we as like Philistine are watching, and that we will never, ever forget, and that we will support them, I think, in any way that they need support. And the work that they're doing right now is more important than anything else that's going on in this world. And that I wish them lots and lots of success, and I pray for their safety.
Yeah, I think it is important to emphasize that, like, it's not that Palestinian mothers necessarily want to have to put everything on the line. Like, they do it willingly, but it's like, you know, they are people with like the same like goals as other people. Like, they have dreams, they have things they want to aspire to be. But the reality for so many Palestinians, especially our mothers, is that they have to sacrifice all those things, because literally resisting this occupation takes everything, and Palestine deserves to take everything also. So that is why we are in that position.
But you deserve joy.
Exactly. And you deserve joy.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Mom. To everybody else, this is Oz. Thank you so much for joining us. If anybody was particularly motivated by this conversation about mothers, I encourage you to visit our webpage at www.codepink.org. We have a lot of info on Mother's Day on there. You can also visit our Palestine page to see, you know, different information and resources on Palestine and everything that's going on right now. Thank you for listening to Code Pink Radio, presented by WBAI in New York City, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, and KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. We will catch you next time.
Bush and Bin Laden, you think they're foes? They're in business together. Daddy Bush knows the Carlyle Group since years before, been raking in billions and itching for more.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
It's blood for oil, we know there's a link.
They say code war,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink till hunger
was not Iraq, but Iran.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
They feed you lies, don't want you to think.
They say code terror,
we say code pink.
Code pink for freedom, code pink for peace, code pink to hunger.
Phones and the places.
voices we meet, they curtail our speech, our movement, our rights, but we won't give up.
We're about to fight. With the wave of the flag, our liberties shrink.
They say code fear,
we say code pink.
With the wave of the flag.